You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Today's broadcast is in memory of Lloyd Ray Smith, Timothy Weichel, and Stephen Corum. Here's the continuation of The Role of Her Life by Kate Anderson Brower. Even amid all the darkness, there was joy. A majority of our patients, as they were dying, were quite capable of laughter and gallows humor, and to an outsider, that often felt really strange or inappropriate. When the hospice was taken over by a more corporate hospital, we got disciplined for too much laughter, and we were eating with the patients, and that was not allowed, Vandenberg said through tears. She fit right in. She knew that was good. She joked with them. She hugged and kissed every single one of us, the patients and the staff. After one of her hospice visits, a patient woke up and said, "I had a vision that Elizabeth Taylor came to me in my sleep." "No, she was actually here," a nurse told him. "Taylor wanted to look perfect for every visit. I hope I haven't overdone it," she'd joke. "So she always arrived with full hair and makeup and the famous 33.19-carat Usher-cut crop diamond on her left ring finger. She wanted the patients to see her the way they had imagined her to be." She told her assistant, Georgette Strum, who would get emotional, that she could not come into hospices with her because she would start to cry if Strum cried. She had to keep things light and happy, she said. But she'd get back in the car, and she would bury her head in her dog's soft white fur and be unusually quiet for a while. Ed Wolf was a counselor in San Francisco General Hospital's Ward 5B in the 1980s. San Francisco was second only to New York in the number of AIDS cases, and 5B was the world's first revolutionary inpatient unit for people with AIDS. It was created in 1983 and run by registered nurses who specialized in caring for AIDS patients. In 5B, patients were treated with compassion. In the beginning, nurses and doctors wore so much protective gear that they looked like astronauts. Food trays piled up outside of hospital rooms because no one wanted to touch them. But in 5B, things were different. Nurses were not allowed to wear protective medical gear, including gowns and masks. They believed that physical touch was an important way to honor each patient's humanity. They did seemingly little things, like recreating the decor of patients' living rooms in their hospital rooms, allowing their pets to visit them, and, of course, allowing their partners to stay with them. They even used champagne glasses for water. "We couldn't cure people, but there was a possibility to heal," Wolf said. "We held weddings for people on their deathbeds, years before it would ever become legal. In 5 minutes, families would find out that their son is gay and he has AIDS. One conservative family from a small town came every single day for 2 weeks until their son died. They saw all these gay people taking care of him, and they did a 180. They went back to their homes and started a support group for people whose kids had AIDS. In other cases, people would bring ministers to get their children to atone. It was a terrible and a beautiful place all at once." Cliff Morrison created 5B, and he remembered one visit when Taylor stayed for several hours. After she spent time with each patient, she asked if there was a lounge area so that she could meet with a larger group. Patients who were feeling well enough to leave their beds came and sat in a circle around Taylor. She told them to feel free to ask her anything. One patient asked her, "What kind of grief and sorrow have you had in your life? And who was the love of your life?" "I was married to Richard Burton twice, and he was the most passionate love of my life. Nobody fought more or loved more than we did," she said. "But Mike Todd was my first true love." Morrison remembers it feeling like sharing a cocktail with old friends, but in this case, it was coffee and cigarettes. "I couldn't believe how comfortable she was," he recalled. They named the lounge after Taylor. In 1986, someone she had never met before wrote her a letter telling her that one of his friends who had done some work on her house was in the hospital dying of AIDS. She had a note delivered with a purple orchid. Purple was her favorite color, and her eyes looked violet in a certain light. To his hospital bed, "My whole house needs redoing, this time in deep purple and lavender, so you have to get out in a hurry and help me. All my love, E.T. This article was from Elizabeth Taylor, The Grit and Glamour of an Icon, by Kate Anderson Brower. Copyright 2022 by Kate Anderson Brower and ERT. To be published December 6, 2022 by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Excerpted by permission. Thank you. Death Tripping. On the road in rural Wisconsin, the author knocks on the doors of houses that bear the darkest American symbols and flags. Behind them, finding guns, ammo, and a modern philosophy of civil war. Story and photographs by Jeff Charlotte. Opening photo shows a wood frame house that looks rather like a shed. Sort of messy outside. A lot of items strewn about, and what looks to be a makeshift wooden coffin standing on end on one edge of the garage area. The thing to worry about is meanings, not appearances. Michael Lessie, Wisconsin Death Trip, 1973. Cecil, Wisconsin. I went back twice to find out what the coffin meant, but though cars came and went in the driveway, nobody ever answered the door. Halloween in June, or a sign, kitsch, or a warning. I'd been driving for a week, since the first night of the January 6th hearings, listening to them on the radio as I counted the flags. Not the American ones, but the Trump ones. Trump 2024, 2 years ahead of time, and the red, white, and blue of the Confederacy. The yellow, don't tread on me, Gadsden. There are so many now. There's new folk art, too. Hand-painted F. Biden placards, homemade Let's Go Brandon billboards, and DIY Never Forget Benghazi banners. The cities and towns still ripple with rainbow pride. Their numbers are greater. But on many country roads, the ugly emblems tick by like mile markers. Next photo shows the interior of a home with flat-screen TV mounted to the wall, watching some sort of riot. Other magazines and things strewn about, and a flag mostly covering the window. What was the coffin, though? I was visiting friends in Cecil, Wisconsin, when we drove past it. They let me out to make a picture. Careful, they said, and we'll come back for you, because they didn't want to linger. They sped away, leaving me in the green light. I made my picture. I waited. I read on my phone, on Twitter, that Wisconsin Republicans had blocked an effort to repeal a dormant 1849 law making any abortion, including for rape or incest, a felony. My friends returned. We fled. The next morning, the ruling came down. Dobbs versus Jackson, which overturned Roe versus Wade, and Wisconsin became the only blue state in which abortion is now effectively illegal. In 1973, the same year the U.S. Supreme Court decided 7-2 that Norma McCorvey, Jane Roe, had a constitutional right to privacy that included reproductive freedom, tennis champion Billie Jean King beat Bobby Riggs in the televised Battle of the Sexes. Richard Nixon declared, "I am not a crook." Henry Kissinger won a Nobel Peace Prize. Also in 1973, a book appeared called Wisconsin Death Trip. It began as a staple-bound pamphlet, and as a book, became an unlikely mirror of its moment, even as it depicted the last 15 years of the previous century. History's like that sometimes. Our faith in the forward motion of chronology suddenly evaporating. Death Trip was, on the surface, a benign album of seemingly ordinary photographs. Portraits, patriotic displays, happy youth, from one small town in Wisconsin, Black River Falls, during the last decade of the 19th century. Interspersed are excerpts from the town newspaper, the Black River Falls Badger State Banner, and whispers from a town gossip. In 1973, a year of crises as varied and vast as those of this year, most white Americans still imagined the previous century as an idyll. Apart from a brief interruption for civil war, fought for reasons they thought romantic, virtuous country life, bustling urban industry, American greatness, the banner spoke other truths: epidemic disease, whole families consumed, diphtheria, the formation in the throat of a false membrane, astonishing bank failure, incendiaries, arsonists who love to watch things burn, vigilance committees, the private made public, a woman, once a model wife and mother, who roamed the state smashing windows. Soul after soul remanded to the asylum. So many suicides. A woman who died from a criminal operation performed upon herself after she failed to find a doctor with the courage to help her. There was beauty in the book, too, even in its carefully arranged photographs of dead infants. That's what you did then when your baby died. If you had the money, you hired the town photographer to make the infant's picture, tucked into a little coffin with flowers, eyes tenderly brushed closed. 30 years ago, the book's author, Michael Lisi, was my teacher. The book, his first, has followed me ever since. "You can get as philosophical as you want," Michael said when I told him I was headed to Black River Falls. He mimicked cheap gravitas. "From the deep ground grows the tree of life. Then comes the end, yours or worse, that of those you love, and nobody likes it when it happens to them. A death trip is a memento mori, is a reminder that everybody dies." If that seems obvious, consider the desperate denial embedded in the phrase "Make America Great Again." The light-eating vanity of Trump, the delusion of a golden brand that will shine eternally. Consider this gloating post-Roe meme: "A thousand-year white boy summer starts today." But nothing lasts forever, not even white boys. A death trip, meanwhile, summons us to the precarious real, not the myth of greatness, the pulse of uncertainty, the living, such as we are. I got the news through a Wisconsin man I'd stopped to speak with that morning, who got it by phone from his wife, who heard it from her doctor, to whom she had gone not to end a pregnancy, but to prepare for one. Mary, who told me her story on the newly necessary condition of anonymity, had been in the stirrups when the ruling came down. She wanted a baby, and this was the next step in the reproductive technology she and her husband had chosen. Until suddenly it wasn't. Following a course of fertility drugs, Mary now possessed 3 mature eggs. The nurse stepped out to consult the doctor. But when the doctor entered the examination room, she said, "I'm holding back tears." "I can't recommend you continue," the doctor said. 3 eggs meant a risk of multiples. Twins Mary could handle. Triplets she could not. Not her finances and not her body. If she went forward, there was a minuscule chance all 3 eggs could be fertilized. 1 embryo might have to be removed. And that, as of 9:11 a.m. Central Time, June 24th in Wisconsin, could be a felony. Marinette, Wisconsin. I was driving north from Mary when I stopped to take a picture and found myself invited into the home of a militiaman. At first, I just wanted to photograph the F. Trudeau flag, an eccentricity in America, Wisconsin, Marinette, from outside the house. Quick work. I left the car running. But I tripped a motion sensor. A woman with cascading honey curls, broad-armed in a tank top, appeared on the back porch. "What you doing?" she asked. I didn't know then that Megan Brum had clocked me as soon as I'd pulled up to the curb, that by the time I squeaked high, I'd already breached 2 of what the family Brum calls its frontiers. I was a stranger on their lawn, which is to say I was one of 3 things. 1. A Fed. Don't shoot yet. 2. An intruder. Be prepared to shoot. 3. A fool. Until proven otherwise. I aced the third option without even trying. I was a writer, wandering Wisconsin, making pictures of flags. Megan brightened. Her husband was a photojournalist, also a wedding photographer. She was joined by a lean, sharp-shouldered young woman wearing an oversized pink tank top that read pink, her eldest stepdaughter, Athena. Baroque ink spiraled around Athena's thin bones. Megan went to fetch her husband, Rob. Athena gazed down on me dead-eyed. Her aim, I'd learn, was the best in the families. Rob emerged, big, buzz-cut, camouflaged, a .45 holstered on his hip. I explained again about the flag. "Want one?" Rob asked. It felt unwise to say no, so I stood dumbly while Rob fetched me my very own F. Trudeau banner, still wrapped in plastic. He'd bought a twofer in solidarity with his Canadian friends. He had a lot of friends, he said, and he had nothing to hide, even if some things would remain classified. So he invited me in. Inside, on a pool table, there was... Well, I asked if I could take a picture of their cat. "Twitch," said Rob, smiling at the kitty. He clicked on the overhead for better lighting. The Brums have 4 cats, and in addition to Athena, there was a 3-year-old with streaming blonde locks zipping around the table. Everybody shoots, even the little one. "How many guns between them?" "Classified." "But those which I could see," said Rob, "were as legal as his combat-grade body armor." He hoisted it to demonstrate its weight, far greater than that used by the police, which he deemed unfit for real battle. "You can shoot me with a 9mm in the chest all day long, and I will laugh at you." He meant it. He shouldered the armor sometimes 8 hours a day. "Training," he said. "I am the head of a local militia." Rob slapped a red patch onto the pool table's felt. 4th Wisconsin, INF. Red Arrow Militia, it read. Next photo shows the interior of a house with a pool table, a lot of guns on it, and a long-haired kitty cat walking around the guns. Legio for Felix Fortunata, fortunate bearer of thunderbolts. I find no record of it online. That's the idea, said Rob. The gear was for an upcoming training operation. Last Friday, he said, we did night ops. He showed me, finger on the trigger, and Megan laughed at my wide eyes. When Rob thought about abortion, he started with guns. The question for him was not whether abortion is right or wrong. The question was, when will China invade? The question was, can we afford to spare potential infantry? If you make the top 10 of things that keep your country running, abortion is not in the top 500. But 10 years down the road, if I have a war and I'm a leader, and you and the black population have aborted 40% of their babies for the past 30 years, I'm running out of foot soldiers. Abortions are bodies that never make it to my front line. It's true that a higher percentage of black pregnancies end in abortion than white ones. Rob's even right about the number, 40. But not the percent. It's 40 out of 1,000, according to the American Journal of Public Health. That is 4%. Rob called himself pro-choice, but that term means something different in his vernacular. He meant the choice of whether or not to murder a baby is up to you. If you choose to do something that's medically possible, I'm going to leave it between you and God until it affects me in the state of readiness of my defense. Readiness. It requires panopticon paranoia, looking for threats down every sight line. Rob looked at falling birth rates. He looked at what he considered Mexico's invasion. He looked at what he suspected would be civil war, according to a rural-urban divide, in which, even though he lived in town, he would side with the land he held outside of it. He looked at China. He noted they ended their population control program in 2021. He contemplated a 1.4 billion red Chinese divided by half, and then by some factor again to account for age, and thinks of hundreds of millions of Chinese wombs churning out multiple Chinese babies. In fact, the Chinese birth rate is falling, and he thought, they're getting ready for the future war. You start prepping several generations ahead to have bodies when you lose so many bodies that you need a level of fresh bodies you never dreamed you'd have to dig into. This way of thinking was, he acknowledged, macabre. But the macabre has flowed into the mainstream, and Rob's convictions are more moderate, in fact, than much of Fox News. Rob did not recall having heard of great replacement theory, the Tucker Carlson-endorsed idea that the left seeks to make conservatism, read whiteness, demographically dwindle, even as it opens U.S. borders to non-white recruits to its un-American ideology. Rob just thought it up all on his own. His ideas are no longer marginal. He knew this, felt it, the convergence of the fringe, the gravity drawing men with guns to the center on January 6, 2021, his photographs of which play in a loop on a screen mounted in the corner of the living room over his youngest toys. Next to a Call of Duty Black Ops poster. Did he carry at the Capitol? I would not answer that question. What he will say is, I did not get robbed by joggers coming out of D.C. Next photo shows the daughter wearing her pink T-shirt and showing her numerous tattoos. He claimed his militia numbers 6,700. Later on the phone, he made it 7,500. Are the numbers real? Inflated, perhaps, but maybe also real enough. As I'd been driving, I'd been listening to a book called How Civil Wars Start by a political scientist named Barbara F. Walter, who in a final chapter projects the next American one's hypothetical opening salvo in Wisconsin. Like Rob, I wanted to be prepared. I'd learned that we're in a golden age of militias, if you like militias, more citizens armed and organized now in varying postures of incipient insurgency than at any time since the last Civil War. Right-wing terrorism used to rise and fall depending on who was president, writes Walter, surging in response to Democrats and subsiding with Republicans in office. President Trump, writes Walter, broke the pattern. Trump said more, and the militias heard him. All the new little armies formed in panicked response to Obama metastasizing. Trump said, stand by, and they gathered. Rob called January 6th a false flag, a hoax, staged, even though he was there. I'd been listening to the January 6th hearings, but who else had? Nobody I'd met on the road. Everybody seemed to know someone who'd participated, or like Rob, had participated. And yet, nobody believed it had really happened. If, as F. Scott Fitzgerald suggested, the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function, such cognitive dissonance is the awful genius of our ecstatically disinformed age. Pro-life, free speech. Athena, for instance, embraced fascism and yet bridled at the name. They call me a Nazi, she muttered, sitting stooped on a tall chair beside the pool table, just because of my German flag tattoo. Sometimes, she said, they told her to kill herself. She didn't say who they were. She bent her shoulder to show proof of their idiocy, They couldn't even tell the difference between a swastika and the Iron Cross. Yes, it's true that the Iron Cross, in conjunction with the German flag, was last used by the Third Reich. But before that, it was a symbol of Imperial Germany. And it was that long-gone nation, she said, to which Athena had dedicated a swath of her left shoulder. Honor and glory for Germany, she said, her voice a low drone. Which was complicated, because Rob considered himself Jewish. I'm not, Athena said. You're Jewish by blood, Rob said. Athena ignored him. Next photos show six different collections of various pro-weapon, pro-Trump, pro-Confederacy flags. Raised Lutheran, Rob said he discovered that his immigrant forebears had converted upon arrival in the late 19th century, fleeing pogroms. Pogroms he could understand. He feared they'll be directed against gun owners. He decided to reclaim his heritage. Details of how and when were classified, but he was, he said, a man of God. He said he was not a Rothschild, which is true, and that Hitler was Jewish, which is not. He said four cats purred through the armory, because four is one of the numbers of God. And when I said I'm a Jew, too, but I'd never heard that, he laughed and told me, you're a bad Hasid, which, fair enough. He was right, though, sort of, about four, especially if you're into gematria, the Jewish code of numbers and words and hidden meanings, popular now with anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists. He said his anti-Semitic comrades in the militia respected him, despite his Jewish blood. Blood, I thought, thinking of the generations of Wisconsin Christians between Rob and his Jewish forebears, thinking of the one-drop rule of color in America that even Nazis deemed extreme, because they're like a wolf pack. He was the alpha. He ruled by strength. They will depose me if I deserve it. A radio on a shelf behind him crackled, and I don't deserve to be deposed. Such was democracy in the 4th Wisconsin Inf Red Arrow Militia. Are you in the militia, too? I asked Athena. I guess, she said. She wasn't the eye contact type. She's one of the people who can actually shoot, Rob said proudly. He'd already explained his belief that of every 100 soldiers, he said he'd been 82nd Airborne, showed me a patch. Only 12 are capable of killing another human being, and only 2 are good at it. She would be one of the 2 out of 100 that I'm absolutely certain of. When advising me on home defense, the broad aim of a shotgun wouldn't work, he said, if the bad guy was holding your daughter hostage. He demonstrated by sighting an inch from Athena's face. She didn't flinch. She agreed that, were she being used as a shield, she'd want her father to use an AR. Rob pointed to the ARs on the table. He said the 3-year-old had already trained on them, shooting prone, the little guy lying on his belly, blasting away. It's really kind of cute. How old were you, Athena, when you started, I asked. Rob answered for her. He picked up a very large handgun, a Taurus Raging Bull 480 Ruger, which, he thought, looked like the mile-long barrel seen in Dirty Harry. She was holding this revolver when she was 2 1/2. 2, Athena corrected. How? I asked, incredulous. 2 hands, said Rob, a proud papa. Favorite thing to hold, Athena said. Rob racked it. God, I love this, he said. The family Brum is, admittedly, a special one. Jewish and German, given to guns and powwows. Looping with Rob's January 6th footage was his video of the Standing Rock pipeline protest. Rob said he's sometimes mistaken for Indian online, but the truth was that the only indigenous ancestry in the family belonged to his daughter-in-law, who he said was a Lakota woman. Still, Rob loved powwows, and he lined up with the water defenders at Standing Rock. Yes, the Brahms are unusual. Their flags are not. They're F. Biden, and their Don't Tread on Me, and their all-black American flag, meant to signal the deepest distress, the fullest readiness, like those window decals I'd been seeing on trucks that said, "Try me," with a gun or a skull. Such was the visual drumbeat the whole of my long drive. The lawn decor cosplay of a populace preparing itself for an imaginary war that threatens to will itself real. Gadsden flags, light and dark, and God flags, eagle and muscle and guns, the old and the new and the what might come next. Mountain, Wisconsin. I kept driving. Near Mountain, Wisconsin, a local took me to meet his favorite billionaire, a rich man who had made a modest fortune, perhaps shy of a billion, by inventing the jalapeno popper. He had plowed it into a small empire of good barbecue and guided hunts. You could possibly bag a white buck. And illuminated at night a curiosity cabinet of magnificently antlered bucks, dozens of heads expertly stuffed. The rich man said it was all for God. He was also interested in artificial intelligence. His brother was investing heavily in Tesla, he said, to get closer to Elon Musk so he could bring him to Christ. Imagine, said the Popper King, what Elon Musk will be able to do when he knows Jesus. The Popper King wondered if we might yet discover the ghost in the works, whether a God-fearing Elon might build for us robots with souls. He wanted Elon to help him build special robots to bottle barbecue sauce. I thought of a recurring theme in Wisconsin Death Trip. Men of the 1890s driven mad, taken off to the asylum by their attempts to invent a perpetual motion machine. I did programs for computers, a retired steel worker named James Schmidt told me, when I dipped across the border to Michigan. Robots and machines and shit. I'd pulled over to snap a picture of his black Second Amendment flag flying in front of the yellow school bus his wife drove. And there's a picture here of that. James didn't have anything particular to say about Roe or abortion because he thought of himself not as an issues man but a big picture type. The picture, as he saw it, is about technology, its decline. He thought the nation's dying for want of invention. He was dying, too, faster than most of us. Stage 4 terminal lung cancer. The black flag was likely his last. He was 59, 2 years into a prognosis with an outside chance of 5. He measured his life by technological collapse. They, the elites, the communists, the city dwellers, try to tell us we live in an age of innovation. This, he said, is a ruse. What has been invented in the last effing 100 and some years? I suggested a few notable items. Chemotherapy, for one. James dismissed each as derivative, wan commentary on an age of American genius 100 years gone. Except, he said, for Elon Musk. I didn't argue. I never do with the well-armed. What has destroyed every great civilization? James demanded. The most powerful force in the universe. I shrugged, and James smiled, because such a cluelessly tepid response from another man was to him just more evidence of the answer. He pressed his thumbs and fingers together, the way teens do to suggest a heart, and lowered the construction over his crotch. He pulsed it open and closed. This, he said, and agreed. What's this? I asked, even though I didn't want to. Pussy. And greed? Women in power, clarified James, making all these decisions, for which he had a solution. In Ashupun, Wisconsin, I pulled over for a display of American flags and a yard sign, Rebecca for Governor. That meant Rebecca Clefish, a GOP candidate, the moderate, who merely agreed with another politician's declaration that pregnant rape victims should turn a lemon situation into lemonade by bearing a rapist child. In the minds of the abortion abolitionist, those who would outlaw it in every instance, it's a matter of finding beauty even within suffering. To Peggy Morrissey, who'd put up the sign, it was the liberals who, she said, drove by and yelled foul things at her flags, who brought ugliness into this world. "There is so much ugliness," said Peggy. They shouted even when her young daughter was in the yard. As a mother, Peggy feared that the ugliness was growing, getting closer. Milwaukee, Madison, cities threatening her immaculate lawn, ugliness everywhere. Education, she said, by which she meant indoctrination. The border, she said, by which she meant we were close to Canada. That one? No. The other one, 1,500 miles south, across which, she said, they waltz. In Howe, Wisconsin, I broke my rule of never approaching a house hidden from the road if it advertises itself with Trump flags, which is why I found myself backing up very slowly before two barking black labs. Their owner was Jerry Pinchert, a fit former contractor with white hair and skin almost exactly the same color as his salmon T-shirt. It was the afternoon of Dobbs, which Jerry told me was good news, but also bad. Good for God, bad for the nation, which now faces chaos. He was a proud no-exceptions man. Rape, incest, God lets it happen for a reason. Life of the mother, no sir, that's up to God. Prayer was all the medicine a mother needs. Jerry didn't consider himself a zealot. Almost nobody I met was particularly pious. Jerry liked wearing his Trump shirt, he said, because the ladies gave him hugs. James, concerned about the exile of God from the schools, growled many times that he didn't give an F what anybody else thought. Jerry said he'd heard they, the others, were calling for riots, part of the Democrat plan for total control that began with killing babies and would end with war in Wisconsin. It's bled through here, too. Not a word, Jerry said, was fully his own. I'd been listening to Fox, to right-wing radio as I drove, and I'd already heard variations of every syllable he uttered. Jerry followed the news. He was a follower. He had not been a good student as a boy, he said, but now he had learned his lesson. The lesson was fear. The lesson was bitter. The lesson was that other people were getting more than their fair share. That grievance flowed naturally from him, from his feelings about baby killers, as if women, by getting to choose, were getting more than their fair share, too. He fretted about the Menominee Reservation, 2 miles away from the country home to which he'd retreated from Green Bay, because he said the city had grown too risky, not just with crime, but those he claimed would barely allow a white man to speak anymore. The Menominee, though, were worse in his view. A lot of them, I believe, are the type of people who want what you and I have, and they're willing to take it. What you and I have? He didn't ask if I'm in fact white, or whether my politics are like his. The latter, to him, was implied by what he observed, correctly, as the whiteness we had in common. "It's coming," he said of war. "With the Menominee? The Democrats? The aborters?" The name of the enemy didn't matter, just that it existed. Jerry was prepared. "We are," he paused, "well supplied. We can defend ourselves." The anger kept twisting. Rob and Peggy and Jerry and James. Abortion and guns and God and whiteness and women and cities and borders, and then guns again. Such is the intersectionalism of fascism. All perceived threats across all time, Indian wars and new Cold War and critical race theory are brutally interconnected. In Wisconsin, a woman bled for more than 10 days from an incomplete miscarriage after emergency room staff would not remove the fetal tissue. That's excerpted from the Washington Post, July 16, 2022. The accounts you're about to read were considered neither sensational nor exceptional when they were printed. That's from Wisconsin Death Trip, as originally published as a staple-bound booklet, 1972. I came across a copy of the original Death Trip, and it's pictured here, published before the book, the movie, the operas, there are two, the many shadows it has since cast across music and literature and film. "Look what I found," I wrote Michael. He called a few hours later. "The issue is," he said, "why is this book still effing breathing?" He'd made the book as a young man, 50 years ago, and now he was old. His hinges, he said, were breaking. He'd had a shoulder replacement, and he needed new knees. His doctor had prescribed him a small daily dose of morphine. He'd made many books since Death Trip, but it was the one that followed him, the book that wouldn't leave him alone. He was an historian, but instead of writing what he'd studied how to write, he'd stumbled into something else, the arcane and actual history behind and within conventional history, he said. The trip, in the book's title, he said, had been a youthful journey. If you drop acid every once in a while, God forbid it should be often, something happens to you. You think that you've been obliterated. And then you realize that you're still alive, and not only still alive, but you look around and it's like a Hollywood movie. You thought you were dead. Now you're not, and you can hear the birds sing. That's exactly what a death trip is like, where you touch bottom. Michael, a very Jewish man, liked rabbinical tales. There's a lot of stuff about touching bottom among some of the Hasidic masters. There was this one great man who used to convene his classes in a cemetery. One of his followers asked the master, "Where are we meeting here of all places?" And the Hasid, the Tzaddik, said, "You have to go down to the bottom in order to realize what the light is. And that's why we are here. In the cemetery, the living, among the dead. It wasn't all so deep. Very little of it was, in fact. All sorts of chatter, absurdity, and dark humor and all that shit," he said. "But the light, behind and within, could be beautiful." Waukesha, Wisconsin. To Waukesha, then, dense white flight suburb of Milwaukee, where last November a man who called himself Mouthboy Fly plowed through a Christmas parade, killing six. Where in 2014, two 12-year-old girls took a third to the woods and stabbed her 19 times. They wanted to ingratiate themselves with Slender Man, an internet meme made real, or real enough, through the knives of children who believed what they read online. Off the highway, where one might typically find a welcome sign boasting of past championships, there's a hillside on which stand dozens of hand-painted billboards. And it's pictured here. They rant against Joe Biden, "Mr. Beijing, bite me." And before him, Obama, against local and state politicians, against tyranny and taxes and education. Creeping critical race theory, warns the newest member of the Waukesha School Board, is intertwined, and it is soft and it is subtle. A fresher sign declares COVIC, C-O-V-I-K, in bright red, bracketed by the jagged lightning bolts of the Nazi SS. "It is all the work of one man," a Waukeshan told me. His discontent is said to have begun some 2 decades ago, when a road project threatened his property, or failed to cross his property and raise its value. Which was it? Nobody I spoke to was certain. It didn't matter. Memes and grievances rise and fall according to the currents of sublimated mourning, eddying around this talking point or that. Sometimes without sense, sometimes in open defiance of reason. Slender Man, Let's Go Brandon, or for instance, the Highland Park, Illinois, 4th of July mass murderer, Bobby Cremo III, who shot to death 7 at a parade. His online life rippled with right-wing hatreds, but he dedicated the panicked days before his crime to a sped-up aesthetic of crashing images and ideologies, sometimes called schizo-wave. A vile term, a grotesque romanticization of mental illness, a metaphor for the quickening of our fragmentation, the great acceleration, a synchronous collapse and explosion of meanings. Up the hill from the signs, in the vast empty parking lot of Elmbrook, which is said to be the biggest church in Wisconsin, I spoke to an old man named Terry. He said he remembered his sorrow the day Roe became law. Life begins at conception, he declared. When the sperm meets the egg, there's an explosion. He raised his hands from his walker, threw them in the air. It's not the baby's fault, he said. He kept saying this over and over. He believed in life, because it is never our fault that we're alive. Like schizo-wave in its verb form, schizo-posting, accelerationism is a relatively recent term, allegedly coined or at least brought into contemporary use in 2013 by two Marxist political scientists via the influence of a two-volume work of 1970s French theory called Capitalism and Schizophrenia. While crisis gathers force and speed, politics withers and retreats, the political scientist hashtag Accelerate Manifesto for an Accelerationist Politics announced, and the overwhelming privileging of democracy as process needs to be left behind. It was a rejection of the slow, small work of solidarity in favor of a future more modern. Yes, said fascist intellectuals, adapting the concept to its own ends. Yes, let's leave democracy behind. The new fascist liked the idea of hastening the end of a liberal order. They repurposed the term for the speeding up of decay, deconstruction, or destruction of the old to make way for the new, an idea which in turn bounced left again and found supporters amongst the anarchist ranks, schizo-waving around a dizzying ideological loop. The instinct to burn it all down is understandable, but here's what fascism does with those matches. January 6th, Dobbs versus Jackson, a decision seemingly tailored to provoke conflict, a long line of mass shooters, Christchurch, El Paso, Buffalo, and now Bobby Cremo of the 4th of July, whom Marjorie Taylor Greene, accelerationist congresswoman of Georgia, has suggested may have acted in a false flag capacity, perpetrating a hoax designed to promote gun control. That would sound like a conspiracy theory, right? She asked. Chuckling, she answered herself, of course, meaning exploding and collapsing. I drove to the woods in which Slender Man received his sacrifice. The girl lived. But the trees had been replaced by playing fields, which were filled with children. So I moved along, ashamed for looking. But shame didn't stop me from walking the Christmas parade route. It was similarly devoid of any sign of the nightmare just recently passed. I stopped for a drink, and the bartender told me that 4 of the victims, the members of the Dancing Grannies, a delightful group that was just as it sounds, had been killed out front. But you'd never know it now. Predicting violence, the night Dobbs came down, Fox News pundit Monica Crowley described pro-choice America as a death cult. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Colexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.